Mayor Yorty has just sent me a message that we've been here too long already. So, my thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there. Thank you very much.
This is Reverse Deception Radio on the Veritas Radio Network, Crusade Channel.
Kennedy and five bystanders were shot as the senator passed through a narrow kitchen pantry just off the ballroom.
Concluded that Sirhan not only did not shoot Senator Kennedy, but could not have shot Senator Kennedy. And the reason for that is Sirhan was never in a position where he could shoot Senator Kennedy from behind. And Senator Kennedy was shot four times from behind. Three of the bullets entered his body, and one went through his suit coat at the right upper seam. In addition to that, five other victims were shot, and no single bullet hit more than one person. Therefore, there were nine bullets into people that had to be accounted for. And that was the minimum amount of bullets. Sirhan's gun only held eight bullets. As a result of the question from the very beginning, how was that possible to get nine shots out of an eight-shot revolver? And of course, that was never answered by the investigating officer.
Welcome to Reverse Deception Radio, my friends. I'm your host, Gregory Carpenter. And yes, that question was never answered. And to this day, that question has not been answered. How did Sirhan fire more bullets than his gun held into the back of Senator Kennedy when he was facing Senator Kennedy? Welcome from the People's Democratic Republic of Northern Virginia. This is Junk Bond, your host, on Reverse Deception Radio. And I'd like to say that Robert Kennedy knew that they were after him. You see, the amorphous they will be explained by the end of the program, so have no fear. But Kennedy himself told his aide, Fred Dutton, April 11th, he said, if they're going to shoot, they'll shoot. He knew that somebody, something, someone was out there, and they were gunning for him. You see, Robert Kennedy made many enemies during the time he was in Washington. And he was well aware of the dangers that he faced in trying to reclaim the presidency lost in 1963 when his brother was assassinated in Dallas. If you need to know or would like to know more about the death and the assassination of JFK, I urge you, please, go pick up my multi-part series on the assassination of JFK. I think you will find there is a plethora of evidence that it was mostly an inside job. And knowing that, Robert Kennedy realized and believed almost immediately that the CIA were the ones that had assassinated his brother. Well, how do you know that, Junk Bond? Well, that just happens to have come out recently with some newly declassified papers from the JFK assassination that were released in the fall. And Bobby Kennedy already knew by the time his brother was shot that it was the CIA. And it goes back to what we talked about during those shows. So please go get them on the on demand. Go listen to them one at a time. Listen to them all together. It doesn't matter. I've got copies of all the papers, and I've told folks before, if you want the information, send me an email, gscarp12@hotmail.com or gscarp12@yahoo.com. Hit me up on the Twitter, @gscarp12. Do you notice a trend, folks? Sure there is. But let me know. You can find me on the Facebook. I'm there. Send me a message. Say, Greg, I'd like to get a copy of the JFK Witnesses Who Were Murdered database. And I'll tell you now, the best way to get this database is to have an FTP server set up so that I can send it to you. I can put it up in the cloud or something like that. It is a very large database. Some of the analysis is mine. Some of it came from other professors at other universities. But realize that everything in there is factual. And that's the part that's very disturbing. Within 3 years of his death, more people died accidental deaths who were on the witness list in the JFK murder than actually have unnatural accidents in a year. And it's so far out of proportion with this just this one population of people who had access to specific information about JFK's assassination. Folks, you won't believe it. So let's focus back on Bobby here again. As you heard in the audio clip, he had just declared victory in the California Democratic primary and was escorted through a kitchen pantry in the Ambassador Hotel. Now, the story goes he was assailed by a Palestinian, Sirhan Sirhan, who was born in Israel. At the age of 12, he moved to the United States. But it was said he had a .22 pistol. Kennedy was shot multiple times, like you heard, three times, one time through the coat. And five other people were wounded by separate bullets. Now, while the bodyguards were wrestling with Sirhan Sirhan, he was continuing to shoot all over the place. And of course, that's how other people got injured. And as you know, Kennedy died the very next day. Interestingly enough, in the assassinations of President Kennedy and Martin Luther King Jr., and we're working in the future on a special for Martin Luther King Jr. too, but in those cases, the evidence tying the alleged assassin to the case was all circumstantial. And wasn't it all so neat? They immediately caught Lee Harvey Oswald. Within an hour and a half, he was sitting quietly in a theater. But here, Sirhan Sirhan was apprehended on the scene firing a gun within a couple of feet of Bobby Kennedy. Makes it sound like an open and shut case, doesn't it? Actually, this is the assassination where I can say that there is stark physical and eyewitness evidence indicating a conspiracy. So who was Sirhan Sirhan? Well, his full name was Sirhan Bishra Sirhan. Early indications of some type of a conspiracy can be found in his diary. His diary? Sure. Page after page in the diary repeated. It had repetitive writing with phrases like, quote, RFK must die, and, quote, Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated. And this was occurring over and over and over again in his diary. But it was always coupled with such really strange phrases like, quote, pay to the order of, and, quote, my determination to eliminate RFK is becoming more of an unshakable obsession. That's exactly what he wrote, folks. I'm not stuttering like I usually do. Matter of fact, on an entry on May 18th that stands out says, quote, Robert F. Kennedy must be assassinated before 5 June 1968. Now, who writes things like that in their diary? I can't think of anybody that I know who would write something, RFK must die, RFK. Even today, you hear the Never Trumpers and the millennials babbling. But who actually writes and says, you know, Donald Trump must be assassinated? I mean, who writes that stuff? You don't write that in a diary. That's not something you do. The thing that was interesting about these types of entries is it came with no determinable plan in the diary. That's why it stands out. You see, the obsessive compulsive disorder activity of just writing in there that RFK must be assassinated is really very superficial, and it doesn't mean anything short of any type of written out instructions on what you're going to do or a playbook. There is no playbook, and we've never seen any type of playbook. Conspiracy number one. Now, Sirhan, as I mentioned, was born in Israel. He was born in Jerusalem in 1944. And the family moved when he was 12 to the U.S. And he had been employed exercising horses at the Santa Anita racetrack. And then there was an accident in 66. And he didn't work there after that. Now, he was obsessed with mysticism, mystical powers, and believed that he was learning to control events with his mind. He was fascinated with hypnosis. Matter of fact, psychiatrists determined that he was highly susceptible to hypnosis and may have produced these writings I mentioned earlier while he was in a trance. Sirhan is an interesting individual than when we look at him overall. He, again, like so many others, was more of an introvert. He didn't get out. He didn't. And mostly, and when you see shootings and things like that, you'll see it's mostly introverts who are the ones that take the initiative, because introverts hold things in. Obviously, they don't let them out. And as it starts to build, there's a certain release point. And when an introvert releases, as opposed to an extrovert, man, all hell can break loose. Now, this doesn't mean to say that Sirhan was the only shooter, or was the shooter that actually hit Bobby Kennedy. But let's go back to the notebook for a minute, back to his diary. The interest, and again, no details, but an interesting thing, Sirhan consistently stated that he has no memory of writing anything in his notebook or in his diary about the events at the Ambassador Hotel. This is kind of, it's starting to sound kind of like the Manchurian Candidate, doesn't it? Now, we talk on this show about technological ability to intercede and have people maybe do things or have their body perform functions that they wouldn't normally do. For example, you can express genes in a different way if you're able to manipulate the genes. Or you can have the body produce too many of one type of hormone or too little of a certain type of a hormone to affect somebody. If you can get them, if you can manipulate the glands that are producing the hormones. And you can do that through surgery. You could do it through nanorobotics. You could do it through a number of ways. Medicine is the typical way that we've historically done these things. But here, complete mind control. Doesn't this kind of fit with the CIA program where they were distributing and using LSD on the population? Yeah, it does sound kind of interesting. It was right around that same time, wasn't it? That, if anything, could be identified as a coincidence, short of having any official document from the government that says that Sirhan was working in one of the government mind control programs at the time. But it is something to think about because, yes, the government, our government itself, was obsessed with this type of research. So who's to say that they weren't successful at any one point? Not me. Not me. If you've just tuned in, this is the Reverse Deception Radio Show on the Veritas Radio Network Crusade Channel. Today we're talking about the assassination of Bobby Kennedy. Now we're going to address the girl in the polka dot dress. Now this was a big issue, and we're going to talk a little bit about this more and explain the importance of the girl in the polka dot dress. Because now let's phrase this first. Sirhan was seen in the hotel. He was seen in the pantry. And both all the times that he was seen with a girl who wore a polka dot dress. Now there was a girl and another man who were seen running from the pantry after the shooting. As a matter of fact, one of the campaign workers for Bobby Kennedy, Sandy Serrano, was taking a break out on the balcony, and she saw them run for the hotel. And what had happened? The woman was shouting, "We shot him! We shot him!" Serrano asked them who they meant, and the girl replied, "Senator Kennedy." That's why the girl in the polka dot dress is extremely interesting and intriguing. This implies that there could have been two or three shooters. The male who was with her, the girl in the polka dot dress, and Sirhan. But don't worry, the official government story says that it was just Sirhan, and, well, he's the guy in jail still. Now, here is something that would really blow your mind, because the girl in the dress and the male companion she was with, their behavior, yelling, saying, we shot him, was corroborated by L.A. police officer, LAPD guy, Paul Sharrigan, who was told the same thing by an elderly couple in the parking lot behind the hotel. Sharaga was the source of an APB on the suspects. The girl was described consistently by almost every witness. Dirty blonde hair, well built, with a crooked or funny nose, wearing a white dress with blue or black polka dots. There were numerous witnesses to the polka dot dress girl. They were in the hotel and in the company of Sirhan in weeks prior to the assassination. Now, this is just not one instance or one witness. There is a number of people who saw her with him. Did Sirhan miss the cue? Was he the one who got left behind? He got played? You can see now, just a few minutes into the show, that there is meaningful physical evidence already that should make an investigator say, there's a lot more to this than just one guy. But they didn't do that. So let's talk about a second gun. The other eyewitness testimony said that there was a second shooter. Dr. Marcus McBoom saw a man with a partially concealed pistol in his hand running from the pantry. Photographer Evan Freed, one of the polka dot dressed girl witnesses, he swore out an affidavit in 1992 that he had seen a gunman, not Sirhan, shoot RFK from behind. Every single witness that was there said that Sirhan was in front of RFK and not closer than a few feet away. Think of the mechanics of trying to be able to take a pistol and hold it behind somebody who you're facing and shooting through their body and hopefully not shooting through their body and shooting you too, right? How ridiculous does this seem? You can't even get a couple minutes into this, right, without understanding that there is a serious issue with the evidence. Evan Freed swore out an affidavit in 1992. Come on. And everybody else saw that he was in front of and not behind RFK. Freed's account and what he saw matches the RFK autopsy report perfectly. The coroner determined that RFK had been shot three times, all from the rear, at a steep upward angle with powder burns, indicating that the fatal shot was fired 1 to 2 inches away from his body. Sirhan had an Iverson 22 revolver that held 8 bullets. 2 bullets were removed from RFK and 5 from other victims. One of the 3 bullets to strike RFK grazed him and was determined by LAPD to have gone into the ceiling. and it wasn't recovered. That accounts for all eight, even conceding the LAPD reconstruction, which explained away bullet holes found in the ceiling tiles, by saying that one of the bullets had ricocheted back down and struck the victim, causing two ceiling holes in the process. Wow, that's like the magical bending bullet shot they got JFK and the governor, huh? Yeah. Well, what isn't accounted for are the bullet holes in the door frame where RFK's party had entered the pantry. Photographic evidence taken by the FBI, LAPD, and AP show bullet holes, which have been circled. Some pictures show police officers pointing at them. One AP photo is labeled "Bullet found near Kennedy shooting scene." Two police officers depicted in the photos told Vincent Bugliosi that they had observed an actual bullet embedded in the wood of the center door frame. The hotel waiter, Martin Petruski, said that the police officers told him that they had dug two bullets out of the center divider. FBI agent William Bailey, in the pantry within hours of the shooting, said he could see the base of the bullet in the center divider. Other confirmation comes from photographers and even the carpenter who assisted in removal of the door frame for the police for their evidence. So how many shots were there? How many bullets were fired, really? Expert opinions say 13. That, by all accounts, would be a very quick discharge of weapons and a very quick reload on Sirhan's part. So the LAPD, let's look at their angle. What did the LAPD do with all the evidence of the conspiracy that I've talked about so far, and others that we're going to get to? The files of their investigation, released 20 years after the assassination, showed that the evidence was ignored and, in some cases, actively countered. What do you mean by that? We're going to talk about polygraphs here in a minute. See, the LAPD set up the Special Unit Senator Group to handle the investigation. Enrique Hernandez was the polygraph guy. He was a rather aggressive polygrapher. And if you know any polygraphers, or if you've ever had the opportunity to have a polygraph done, you know what I mean when I say aggressive. They do it to try to get you to reveal that you're lying about something. See, many times people just get fed up because, well, these polygraphers are, insert foul mouth word here, ends in H-O-L-E-S. Yes, they're just stinking annoying. And you want to bop them in the nose or bop them on the head and say, dude, get a life. Enrique Hernandez was one of these. Why? Let's take the case of Sandy Serrano. She was a prime witness to the girl in the polka dot dress and the male companion. She was browbeaten by Hernandez. She was browbeaten so badly, psychologically manipulated. She actually retracted what she said. Hear from a transcript of one of their exchanges. Hernandez, I think you owe it to Senator Kennedy, the late Senator Kennedy, to come forth, to be a woman about this. If he, and you don't know, and I don't know whether he's a witness right now, in this room watching what we're doing here, don't shame his death by keeping this thing up. I have compassion for you. I want you to know why. I want to know why you did what you did. This is a very serious thing. Serrano, I see those people. Excuse me, I seen those people. Hernandez, no, 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 Sandy. Remember what I told you about that. You can't say you saw something when you didn't see it. Eventually, Serrano recanted her story and she went along with the LAPD. And once she retracted her story, the fact that Serrano made up the story was apparently used to discredit other corroborating witnesses who generally didn't know that their story was being repeated by others. As a matter of fact, the story about the lady in the polka dot dress, the evidence, the testimony given by all the people, almost the same. It was almost exactly the same. There were dozens of witnesses. They all said the same thing. She said, "We shot him. We shot him." Everybody said she said that. Hernandez got Sandy to fall. He broke her. And then used that to leverage everybody else that he brought in for a polygraph into recanting their stories. Now, is that the way you conduct an objective investigation? I have never, in all my years of working with Los Federales, I have never once heard of or seen an investigation conducted in such a manner. It's probably because I don't work for the LAPD or the FBI, is what's being insinuated here. I tell you, though, people need to understand there is a great amount of intimidation that is built around a cover-up. That's the way the cover-up stays in place. And like we were talking this morning on Mike's show, the intimidation, the torture, the use of the black sites, this was a white site per se. We all knew that everybody was going into the LAPD station and they were going to get their testimony written down. And we all knew what came out of that. And it seemed extremely strange that something everyone saw turned into something no one saw. When the news was there and they were talking to people, it was reported that people saw the lady in the polka dot dress. It was discussed. It was on the open news. And all of a sudden, after meeting the police and discussing what they saw, police writing down their story, taking a witness statement, if any lawyer or anybody I knew who had done that to a witness, be charged with witness tampering. So why is it so important? And this is the question. Why is it so important to cover up the assassination of Bobby Kennedy? In the assassination of JFK, we had to get a little bit further into the show to even be able to bring up information that made people scratch their heads a little bit more. Here, we're seeing an active cover-up unfold before your eyes. Quite an amazing thing, considering how much people say they trust the people in blue and, you know, all cops' lives matter and all that really cool stuff. And don't get me wrong, I got nothing against cops. I got nothing against most people in the federal government either. However, there is a group of people that work within these institutions that make things like this possible. Now, a lot of these evidence, this eyewitness evidence that LAPD collected, was ignored. And then, to add insult to injury, a lot more was lost. The missing evidence included the memo of Paul Chiraga, the officer who interviewed the elderly couple who saw the woman in the polka dot dress fleeing the scene. He had enough presence of mind to retain the original mimeograph, though. You ever see a mimeograph? Holy cow. Those things are old, right? So are we. But he had the original, and he kept that, even though his memo was lost of their statement. The door frames, which according to many witnesses had bullets embedded in them, were destroyed by the LAPD after Sirhan's trial. They were not admitted into evidence in the trial. Other evidence, including photographs taken in the pantry, never saw the light of day. So now we have witness tampering. We have evidence tampering. The LAPD summary report deals with many of the witnesses to accomplices or other evidence indicating conspiracy and dismisses them all in a variety of ways. In some cases, for example, the polka dot dress girl witness, Booker Griffin, witnesses are said to have admitted making up their story. But inspection of the raw LAPD files fails to substantiate the alleged retractions. Meaning, didn't happen. Did not happen. Not all of them retracted their story. Some of them did after they heard, they got Sandy's. After they saw that information, they retracted it. And they were put under scrutiny by Hernandez, who twisted their words and attacked them viciously. So you have to think about this. What does Hernandez have to lose? What skin does he have in the game for abusing witnesses in such a manner? Interesting. Yes, a conspiracy does start to form. It does come together when you see all of the moving parts. Everything that's needed to pull off an assassination of a high-ranking government official appears to be very complex and even done in the middle of a room full of other people. 2/3 of the people get away and they're never pursued. Does that not sound shaky? Should we be watching this on one of the episodes of Cold Case? Because that's what it seems like. Nobody's going after these people. And why? As I read through and I've read through all the reports and the evidence that I've collected lately on the Bobby Kennedy assassination, I sit and I look and I wonder how much of this stuff really got into the defense team's hands. I mean, wouldn't the evidence have been given to Sirhan's lawyers? They would have certainly brought a lot of this information and submitted it into evidence. But sadly enough, not all the evidence was shared with his lawyers. As a matter of fact, the autopsy report, whose conclusion of point-blank shots from the rear would pretty much exonerate Sirhan of the actual murder, but it wasn't given to the defense until they had already stipulated Sirhan's guilt. It wasn't even a fact of discovery to share that. They deliberately withheld it from the defense team. So, see, the strategy that the defense team took was they decided to pursue what's called a diminished capacity defense. So the autopsy really didn't change that strategy. So it made them force their hand without giving them the autopsy. How much different would the trial of Sirhan have been if they were given the autopsy report that clearly shows Sirhan could not have shot Bobby Kennedy in the back as he stood in front of him, as testified by all the the witnesses. Yeah, most of them didn't get into the trial either. They were deposed, and statements were taken, but they weren't shared with Sirhan's lawyers either. Now go figure that. I find it interesting, you know, here in the States. There's a saying, it's called the great engine of truth. That's the legal system, right? You know, and the funny thing about this is neither side really had anything to gain by bringing in evidence of any type of conspiracy. Think about it. For the prosecution, it would have muddled what otherwise seemed to be a rather simple case if they brought more people in. And they would have lost out because, you know, a man would have walked. And for the defense, conspiracy implies premeditation and thus knowing guilt. Introducing evidence of accomplices wouldn't have been helpful for Sirhan either. So it was kind of a heads you lose, tails you lose for Sirhan. Matter of fact, he was his own worst enemy at the trial. He used it as a platform for expressing anti-Semitic political views and touting the Arab cause. Not something I would think that would be important to do when you're, you know, on trial for murder. Now, I got to tell you, folks, he had plenty of opportunity to talk about the murder itself. So if it was just yelling and screaming about the Arabs and Jews, that was the motivation for the shooting. I'm not really sure how it could be, but if it was, well, he made a lot of noise and nobody remembers it because he's a guilty guy and he went to jail, and that's where he's at today. So he still doesn't remember anything about murdering Kennedy. So if you're listening, if you just tuned in, you're listening now, this is Greg Carpenter, Reverse Deception Radio on the Veritas Radio Network Crusade Channel. And we're talking about the assassination or the execution of Bobby Kennedy in Los Angeles, in the kitchen of the hotel. We've laid out some evidence now, and next show we're going to broaden this a little bit more, and we're going to talk about some of the other aspects of what was happening. Today, we're going to finalize this section with the ballistics and talk about the ballistics of these the rounds that hit Kennedy. Now, we're going to start off, and I'm going to talk about Ted Karasch. He produced a documentary in 1970. It was called The Second Gun. And, of course, there were still questions about RFK's murder, right, going into the early 70s, and even into the mid-70s. And they were still questioning his brother's murder into the mid-70s and the 80s. Even today, most people think JFK was assassinated through a conspiracy of multiple people. It was not a single lone gunman. But what are people doing about it? Nothing. Do they raise their voice? Do they scream? Do they demand that the government release all the information that it has on the JFK murder, on the Bobby Kennedy murder, on the Martin Luther King Jr. murder? No. That's not the type of people we're talking about anymore these days. People in this union will sit, raise their voice, hoop and holler, and then jump on Amazon and go buy themselves something nice for them because they deserve it. And see, it's not that important anymore. The truth has fallen off. It's not important. As strange and as funny as it may seem, we prefer to live with the comfort of the lies without causing any type of ruffling of feathers. Let me ask you folks out there a question. If you dig into something like this and you find information, are you willing to have the government come and beat you down to get that information out to the rest of the world? Are you? You realize that the government does have goons that do these things. This is why it's so important to bring this information out. I believe that there's other people out there that are interested in finding out and pursuing and making the government show its hand. Aren't we the ones who are supposed to give the power to the government to do what we want it to do? Here, the government's telling everybody what they can and what they can't do. I think we have it upside down. Let's get back to the ballistics here. Herbert McDonald was a criminalist. He had signed an affidavit in 1973 stating that a bullet removed from RFK's neck, which was identified as exhibit number 47, could not have been fired from Sirhan's gun. He further stated that based on the differing number of grooves, it could not have been fired from the same gun as exhibit 54, a bullet removed from victim William Weasel. In a 1974 public hearing, California State Crime Lab veteran Lowell Bradford concurred. We have credible, authoritative witnesses and experts stating that there is no way that these two bullets came from the same gun, number one, and number two, that the bullet that came out of Bobby Kennedy was not fired from the .22 that Sirhan had. That should be open and closed. How easy is that? We've just solved the Bobby Kennedy murder. We've identified that there's a conspiracy. Again, in 1975, a court-appointed panel of seven ballistics experts was convened. While the headlines coming from the panel's work read, RFK, second gun theory, ruled out. The reality was more subtle. Lowell Bradford, one of the panel members, said the question of a second gunman was more open than before. Who do you think put the news out? Who do you think put the panel together? Additional research uncovered serious problems with the marking of evidence bullets. Following the trail of Pasadena criminalist William Harper, researcher Rose Lynn Mangan discovered evidence of a switch of crime scene bullets. For example, she found that the Kennedy neck bullet number 47, which should have a TN31 etched in its base, instead says DWTN. There's a reason to believe that even the Sirhan gun was swapped with another gun. LAPD criminalist Dwayne Wolfer had in fact introduced into evidence at Sirhan's trial the test gun and represented it as the murder weapon. Despite different serial numbers. This is what we call cheating. I think it's worth noting that the 1975 panel discovered that two bullets allegedly removed from Sirhan's car contained traces of wood on both the base and the tip. Were these the bullets that were dug out of the door frame? So why were they in Sirhan's car? More questions than answers, folks. More questions than answers. 2004 tape recording, which featured the gunfire in the pantry, surfaced. The tape was analyzed by a team led by Philip Van Prague. He announced the tape revealed 13 shots fired in the space of 5 seconds. Sirhan's gun held 8 bullets. So, what's the real answer, folks? Was he really the victim of a conspiracy? Or just happened to walk in between two people that were shooting each other? And what of the girl in the polka dot dress who ran away and said, "We shot him, we shot him, we shot Senator Kennedy," that was seen by every stinking person there? And they saw her with Sirhan weeks before. When something stinks, it stinks, folks. Next week, we're going to wrap up, and we're going to get into the rest of the information and evidence that we've collected here on the Reverse Deception Show. I want to thank you all for coming by and stopping by the Democratic People's Republic of Northern Virginia today in a beautiful snowstorm. Aloha, and God bless you all. Have a great and wonderful day.
This is Reverse Deception Radio on the Veritas Radio Network, Crusade Channel.